and the Fundamentals of Jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Well, let's talk about Quds, the ritual bath, according to the fatwas of Ayatollah Sistani. How is a tartib or sequential ghusl done or performed?
Well, tartib ghusl or the sequential ghusl means that one has to start washing his head and neck first. Mm-hmm. Head and neck first.
Right.
And then he has to wash the right side of his body and then the left side.
Mm-hmm.
Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that it's not necessary to observe sequence between the right side of the body and the left side of the body, okay? Contrary to many other fuqaha and scholars who are of the view that even the sequence has to be observed between the right side of the body and the left side.
But what about the head?
Of course, when it comes to the head and the neck, of course you have to wash your head and neck, okay, first. That sequence has to be observed.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes
but
to the right
first is the condition for every marja, for every religious body.
Yes.
Okay.
And when it comes to the right side of the body and the left side, of course, it is better, according to Ayatollah Sistani, to observe the sequence. But if you happen not to observe and you wash your body at once without even taking consideration of the left and the right sides, then it's not necessary. And of course, your ghusl will not be affected, okay? And let me tell you one thing. We have, ghusl under shower, okay? Under shower. Because you stand under shower and the water falls
on you,
on your head, and then your body, all your all parts of your body becomes wet. Now, Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that, okay, you have to wash your head and neck first under shower, and then you have to, let's say, stop the water, or you can just turn off the water and then turn it on again to let the water fall on your body, okay? You cannot, based on obligatory precaution, this is just a precaution, it's not a fatwa, okay? Based on, as an obligatory precaution, a person has to stop the water and then start washing his body when he is taking bath or when he is performing ghusl under a shower, okay?
Right.
And poorer countries, in some countries or some families, of course, do not have a shower in their bathroom or in their bathroom. So they use a tub. They fill the tub with water and then they use something to pour water on their heads and necks, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And for performing ghusl, it's not necessary to use a lot of water, okay? It is permissible to, it's what is necessary actually is to make water reach the body, okay? Reach the body.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessary to wash your body twice or thrice or to make sure that no part of your body remains, let's say, remains dirty, okay?
Mm-hmm.
To make water reach your body is sufficient. Even if the water does not flow off, okay? Yes, if the water remains on your body, it does not fall off, it does not trickle down, it is sufficient, okay? And many, let's say, ladies who have long hair, they wonder whether it is permissible for them to just wash their head and not their hair. Of course, it's not necessary to wash your hair during ghusl. Yes, to make water reach the scalp or the skin of your head is enough. It's not necessary to wash your head, your hair, because it takes long time for the hair to dry up and to get dry. Of course, some families don't have the hair dryer, and so it's very much difficult for mm-hmm. women to keep wet hair in the winter season when it takes time for the hair to dry.
I see.
So washing the hair is not necessary.
Uh-huh. That's a very good point. Thank you very much, Sheikh.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
What about some areas of dirt on the body? Is it necessary for a ghusl to be completed? In fact, to clean the body from any kind of impurities before performing an obligatory ghusl?
Well, that's also a very good question. One who performs ghusl must make sure that no part of it, or that no external substance or no dirt is there on his or on her body. Okay. If a person happens to find a piece of dirt on his body after he or she completes the ghusl, and when he comes out of the bathroom and finds that there is some dirt on his, let's say, body, on his legs, on his hands, on and so on. So it is not necessary in this case to perform the ghusl all over again, okay? Yeah, it is just necessary to remove the dirt and then wash that part of the body with the intention of completing the ghusl. So it's not necessary to take off your shirt and then just to make water reach that part of the body is sufficient. After removing the dirt, after removing that thing which forms a kind of impediment, a kind of barrier making water not to reach the skin. So after removing
like
that...
Like a patch of oil, yeah, for example?
It can be anything which is considered impediment or barrier
mm-hmm.
in common view, okay? So it has to be removed, and that part of the body should be washed, okay? Or water has to be made to reach that part of the body.
The skin, yeah, basically.
And the intention is to... the intention one has to... one should keep is to complete his ghusl,
mm-hmm.
okay? And it should be noted that there's no consecutiveness, or you can say it,
order,
or succession mm-hmm. in ghusl. Mm-hmm. You know, you can, for example, wash your head and neck in the morning,
mm-hmm.
and then wash the right side of your body at noon, and then wash the rest of your body in the evening. So. It's not necessary to wash the second part immediately after the first part, and then the third part immediately after the second part.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much again, Sheikh, for the complete and nice answer you provided to the previous question. But another question regarding performing ghusl would be the fact that is it necessary to place the hands over the body parts to flow the water over it? We know that. You know, in wuzu, for example, we put the hands after rinsing that part, or when we pour like a handful of water on our arms, for example, from the elbow to the tip of the fingers, we rub it gently
yes.
across, right? All over from the elbow to the tip of the fingers. And we basically direct the water and rub our skin gently by rinsing it. Is it necessary to do the same thing for ghusl?
It is absolutely not necessary to rub off, okay, the water and to make water flow out of your body or to flow off your body.
Okay.
And of course, rubbing is not a necessary condition.
Mm-hmm.
Rubbing, the aim of rubbing the body while doing ghusl is to make sure that water has water reaches all parts of the body, because some parts of the body, like for example, there are some poles, like there might be some hair, okay, which may prevent water from, you see, mm-hmm. reaching the skin. In that case, you rub your body to make sure that water reaches the skin. Otherwise, rubbing itself and of itself is not required. It's not obligatory.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are with you to discuss the first part of Imam Khomeini's testament, where he explains Hadith Thaqalain, meaning the Quran and the progeny of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Imam Khomeini passed away in 1989, but his thought and way has remained for seekers of truth, justice, and freedom. The Imam has left behind his testament, which illuminates the path of the Islamic revolution. We are going to discuss the main axes of his testament in a number of episodes. Stay tuned, please. Writing of Testament has its roots in old times. The Arabs, before the advent of Islam, used to write their last will. It was also common in Iran. Like many good customs, Islam didn't rule out this custom and rather strengthened it. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, in different hadith, recommended Muslims to write their last will before death. He advised Muslims to determine their properties for their heirs according to Quranic teachings. The Prophet himself mentioned 9 main points in his testament, namely sincerity, justice, moderation, pardoning of other things, spending for others, bond with relatives, thinking in creation, remembrance of God, and admonishing through the marvels of creation. The custom of writing testament continued after the Prophet's passing away. Imam Khomeini, as a true student of the Prophet's school, wrote a comprehensive testament which became known as the Imam's Political and Divine Testament. This testament is considered as one of the charters of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic. It includes many features of the discourse of the Islamic Revolution. Imam Khomeini starts his testament with praising God and greeting the Prophet and his infallible progeny. Then he addresses the Hadith Thaqalain. Hadith Thaqalain was said by the Prophet of Islam and reads, "Indeed, I am leaving behind among you two weighty things, the Book of God and my progeny, my Ahlul Bayt. They will never part each other till they join me at the Pond Kothar." Imam Khomeini says in his testament that Hadith Thaqalain has been mentioned by both Shia and Sunni scholars so repeatedly that it has made it a decisive and firm document. He says, "After the passing away of the Messenger of God, whatever occurred to one of the two things, including the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt, has occurred to the other one too. The loneliness of one is the loneliness of the other, so that these two lonely things will go to the Messenger of God at the pond. And it should be said that the oppression that the rebels, the ungodly rulers, have done to the two, trust of the noble Prophet, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, has been done to the Islamic Ummah, and rather to the whole mankind." Imam Khomeini, after pointing to Hadith Thaqalain and the importance of the Quran and the Prophet's progeny, briefly analyzes what happened to these two things. He says that after the martyrdom of Imam Ali, peace upon him, egoists and rebels expelled the noble Quran from the scene and completely nullified the divine just rule. Thus, they found a deviation from the religion and Book of God. Imam Khomeini laments, "Now let us see what has happened to the Book of God, this divine trust and legacy of the Prophet of Islam, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The sad things that one should shed tears of blood for them began after the martyrdom of Imam Ali, peace upon him. The egoists and rebels used the noble Quran as an instrument for their anti-Quran rules. Through different excuses and pre-designed conspiracies, they expelled real exegetes of the Quran and those familiar with the realities who had gained the whole Quran from the noble Prophet, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and the call of, 'Indeed, I am leaving behind among you two weighty things,' was in their ears. They expelled the Quran and the Ummah from the scene by the Quran, and they nullified the divine rule of justice, which has been one of the ideals of this holy book. And they founded the deviation from the religion of God and the book and the divine tradition to the extent that one is ashamed of writing them down." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, stresses that the rebels, the ungodly rulers, expelled the noble Quran from the scene in a way that they used it to justify their own vested interests. The Imam writes in his testament, the more this errant foundation advanced, the more waywardness and deviation increased, so that the noble Quran, which was sent down from the lofty status of one God to the hand of Prophet Muhammad for the growth of the world people, and is the point of gathering of all Muslims and rather mankind to take the world to justice, was expelled from the scene in a way as if it had no role in guidance. And what is worse is that the role of the Quran in the hand of the oppressive rulers and scholars who were more wicked than rebels changed into an instrument for practicing oppression and corruption and justification of oppressors and opponents of Almighty God. Imam Khomeini continues with deep sorrow. Unfortunately, the Quran, this faith-building book, by conspiring enemies and ignorant friends, has had no role except in graveyards and the places of the dead. And the book, which should be the tool of convergence of Muslims and mankind and the boom of their life, turned into the tool of discord and difference and was totally expelled from the scene. Dear listeners, next time we will continue the issue.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Since 2010, Israel has been linked to at least a dozen of attacks on Iran's nuclear program. These operations were aimed at disrupting Iran's progress in the field of peaceful nuclear technology through acts of sabotage targeting Iran's nuclear facilities and assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. Between 2010 and 2012, four Iranian scientists, Masoud Ali Mohammadi, Majid Shahriari, Dariush Rezai Nejad, and Mohsen Ahmadi Roshan, were assassinated, while another scientist named Fereydoun Abbasi was wounded in an attempted murder. Also, in November 2020, another top Iranian nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, was assassinated in a roadside attack. Iran blamed the killing on Israel and condemned it as terrorism. Tehran also slammed world bodies for their silence on the acts of terrorism targeting the Iranian nation and its elite personalities. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv neither confirmed nor denied its involvement in the attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities and scientists. However, last week, Israel's Channel 12 aired an eye-opening interview with former Mossad chief Yossi Cohen, who led the spy agency for more than 5 years. Yossi Cohen hinted at Tel Aviv's involvement in two explosions over the last year at Natanz nuclear facility, as well as the assassination of a prominent nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. He also shamelessly threatened Iranian scientists involved in the country's nuclear program with death. That's while Israel has always pursued a policy of deliberate ambiguity over its nuclear capabilities, as well as the issue of targeted killings and airstrikes. Iran's mission to the United Nations slammed Israeli lawlessness, saying that Cohen's comments reflect Tel Aviv's long-standing strategy of criminal sabotage against Tehran. Cohen's interview is aired as talks to revive Iran's nuclear deal are about to resume amid hints of progress. The Israeli regime has been the nuclear deal's strongest opponent, although the United Nations, the European Union, and others have hailed it as a diplomatic success. Iran has repeatedly complained about Israel's attacks, with Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Kazem Gharibabadi, warning as recently as Thursday that the incidents not only will be responded to decisively, but also certainly leave no option for Iran but to reconsider its transparency measures and cooperation policy. Gharibabadi also slammed IAEA's silence in the face of terrorist attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities and the assassination of scientists. Israel has constantly accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of the weaponization of its peaceful nuclear program and assassinated several Iranian nuclear scientists in recent years. However, Iran has rejected all these accusations, as it was among the first nations to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and it has been under the most intense scrutiny and inspection by the IAEA than any country in the world. That's why the Israeli regime itself has, under constant U.S. protection, avoided joining the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and is now in possession of hundreds of nuclear warheads and other non-conventional weaponry.
Israel is saying that it claims a right to commit any act of murder or sabotage against Iran that it wishes. But what Israel doesn't realize, and what Israel's American backers don't realize, is that that these kinds of actions virtually force Iran or other such countries to take equivalent measures against Israel and the U.S. So they're opening up a Pandora's box by opening the international scene to all kinds of acts of murder, sabotage, revenge, etc. And every country will claim the right to do so, and they'll cite Israel as an example. So as I said, Israel is playing with fire here and is going to get burned because equivalent measures will be taken against it.
The revelation of outgoing Israel's spy agency that Israel was behind recent attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities and its top scientists shows that it has no respect for the law. That's why Israel has followed a deliberate policy of ambiguity for years. It seems favoritism towards Israel by the International Atomic Energy Agency, as well as Washington's invariable support for the regime, has given it the green light to break international law. Isn't it high time for the international community to hold Tel Aviv accountable for its crimes?
When the novel coronavirus began to spread around the globe in early 2020, many were pinning their hopes on herd immunity as a means to end the pandemic. A slow process in which a majority of the population becomes immune to the disease, making the transmission harder. But scientists began their studies on the contagion from early on to understand the virus and produce a vaccine. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine became the first to obtain the World Health Organization's approval for emergency use, offering the world a glimmer of hope in the fight against the deadly respiratory disease. Months later, however, the world is still struggling with the pandemic and its impact on the lives of its 8 billion inhabitants. While new cases and deaths have sharply fallen in richer nations, poorer countries, including those in Africa, are witnessing soaring infections and fatalities. Many observers, including the WHO, attribute that to vaccine inequity.
6 months since the first vaccines were administered, high-income countries have administered almost 44% of the world's doses. Low-income countries have administered just 0.4%. The most frustrating thing about this statistic is that it hasn't changed in months. Inequitable vaccination is a threat to all nations, not just those with the fewest vaccines.
Well, I think that it's never too late if you're talking about saving lives around the world, but I believe that it's absolutely true that we should have approached this pandemic as a global problem from the very beginning. If all of the countries had teamed together and distributed the vaccines across the globe early on, I think we would have seen much, much less death and devastation due to this pandemic. So, you know, yes, it's wonderful that some countries are stepping up now and offering doses of the vaccine, but absolutely this should have been done, you know, 12, 13, 15 months ago.
Human rights groups and charities are calling on the world's richest nations to do more to help bring the pandemic to an end. Ahead of his visit to the United Kingdom to attend the G7 summit, U.S. President Joe Biden unveiled America's plan to help poorer nations fight the COVID-19 outbreak.
The United States will purchase 500 million doses of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine to donate to nearly 100 nations that are in dire need in the fight against this pandemic.
Other G7 nations have also pledged to chip in to meet the group's 1 billion dose target. In the meantime, health and anti-poverty campaigners say while the G7's pledge is a step in the right direction, it falls short of the number of doses needed to win the battle against the pandemic. Charity organization Oxfam said, to end the COVID crisis, the world needs 11 billion doses of vaccines. It also called on the G7 to support a push for a waiver on the intellectual property rights behind the vaccines, a move that would give other nations better access to the much-needed jabs.
I think that the amount of doses being offered are absolutely a drop in the bucket, and we've seen certainly here in the United States that the country was very, very cautious about releasing doses, hoarding doses, really, of the vaccine for a very long time, partly with a notion of protecting the local residents first before sharing vaccines with the rest of the world. And I do think this is a very short-sighted approach because the vaccine does not know boundaries. The vaccine does not know national borders. And so as we've seen with the way the pandemic spread, you have to vaccinate the entire world in order to protect everyone in the world. So the idea of reserving doses just for your own population, I think, is very, very short-sighted on the part of all of these countries.
According to Johns Hopkins University, over 2.2 billion doses have been administered worldwide as of June 12, 2020. At this rate, several countries are expected to fall short of the WHO's target of inoculating 10% of their population against the infectious disease by September.
The diplomatic relationship between the United States and its geopolitical rival Russia is severely strained. A series of tit-for-tat actions has left bilateral diplomatic ties in tatters. Such actions date back to the 1980s, but they have escalated over the past years. In 2016, America expelled dozens of Russian intelligence operatives. In response, Moscow expelled more than 700 American diplomats the following year. Later, the U.S. ordered the closure of Russian consulates in San Francisco and Seattle. Russia ordered the closure of the U.S. consulate in St. Petersburg in 2018. Earlier this year, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden announced sanctions on Moscow and expelled 10 Russian diplomats. In response, the Russian Federation announced that it was sanctioning several high-ranking U.S. officials and expelling 10 American diplomats. Right now, the U.S. and Russia have withdrawn their ambassadors from their respective capitals. Such tit-for-tat actions have resulted in a dramatic reduction in the diplomatic footprint in Moscow and Washington, making it very difficult to even conduct basic diplomacy. Moscow and Washington have deep differences over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine, arms control, human rights, and cybersecurity. Observers believe such differences have their roots in the geopolitical rivalry between the two superpowers around the world. ties between the United States and Russia are once again under the spotlight, as the U.S. president and his Russian counterpart are scheduled to meet next week. During their upcoming meeting, the American president is expected to raise very touchy issues with the Russian leader. Those sore points include allegations of Russian interference in American elections and Moscow's involvement in Ukraine, where Russia and the West have been locked in a tug of war for years. This week, Biden had tough words for Russia just days ahead of the high-stakes Geneva meeting. He warned that Moscow faces robust and meaningful consequences if it engages in, quote, harmful activities.
What the United States is trying to do is to act like they are tough for domestic consumption. You know, what goes on between the two leaders, what exactly Biden would be afraid of, we don't know. What worries United States the most is the whole situation with Ukraine, because United States put all their bets and all their sort of cards and all their money into Ukraine.
Before Biden sits down for talks with Putin in Geneva, he is consulting with European leaders at the G7 in Britain and the NATO summit in Brussels. Biden is expected to try to build pressure on the Russian Federation. America views Russia as the second most serious threat after China. While former U.S. President Donald Trump tried to avoid penalizing Russia on the world stage, in his first 100 days in office, Biden imposed new sanctions on Moscow and expelled nearly a dozen Russian diplomats from the U.S. Biden seems intent on taking a tougher line on Moscow. How will Putin react? The Russian leader is known for refusing to back down. The upcoming meeting in Geneva may not produce a breakthrough, but its outcome will probably provide a hint about the future course of relations between the two rivals.
At first, it was dismissed as a conspiracy theory, but now the idea is gaining traction and international attention. The coronavirus, or COVID-19, as it became known, may have originated from a laboratory in Wuhan. This was a claim that former U.S. President Donald Trump had stated, in which he received a lack of flak for calling it a Chinese virus. But what has led to a rise in this theory? The fact that the virus leaked out of a laboratory in Wuhan was never really dismissed outright in the first place. Now, a report on the origins of COVID-19 by a U.S. government national laboratory concluded that the hypothesis of a virus leak from a Chinese lab in Wuhan is plausible and deserves further investigation.
My take is that the American government is changing its attitude from time to time and aimed more at being anti-Donald Trump and anti-China than anything else. It does not recognize that it really was a biowarfare weapon, as I and others firmly believe.
This was apparent when, as recent as last week, U.S. President Joe Biden announced that the intelligence needs to be gathered as to the origins of the virus. U.S. intelligence agencies are considering two likely scenarios: that the virus resulted from a laboratory accident, or that it emerged from a human contact with an infected animal. Meanwhile, U.S. government sources said a classified American intelligence report circulated during the Trump administration, which alleged that the three researchers at China's Wuhan Institute of Virology became so ill in November 2019 that they sought hospital care. U.S. officials have accused China of not being transparent about the virus's origin, a charge Beijing denies.
The U.S. moves to shift the blame of COVID-19 is no different from its lies on Iraq's position of weapons of mass destruction. The international community should be vigilant about this. I'm sure such moves will be rejected by people with insight. We urge the U.S. to stop politicizing this study of origins, stop smearing China, adopt an open and transparent attitude on this issue, shoulder its due responsibilities, and invite WHO experts for origin studies in the U.S.
Numerous questions arises out of all of this, and the one that clearly needs to be answered is, why is the U.S. president highlighting the results of the intelligence findings at this point in time? Was he not aware of the intelligence reports like during the time Trump was in power?
My take, again, is that Biden was and the Democratic Party were doing this as a result of their opposition to Trump and to make him look bad. He's now involved in investigating this because it makes China look bad, and China is now the new enemy.
Furthermore, the WHO at one point clearly rejected the hypothesis that the virus was a result of a laboratory break or to have originated from a lab in Wuhan. It even had a team in Wuhan to investigate this, and the head of the World Health Organization mission said it was, quote, extremely unlikely that the virus spread from a lab leak in the city of Wuhan. Now, after over a year of the outbreak, several Western powers and prominent scientists have publicly stated as woefully inadequate the findings of the WHO. They have stated that those findings were relied on data collected by Chinese officials. This has led to many to conclude that the U.S. is taking political advantage of this in order to gain points against China.
Well, yes, indeed. The U.S. is doing this to obtain political advantage over China, to paint them as an enemy, has ignored its own involvement in the matter in the past, and is ignoring its own flip-flopping over the last year and a half or so.
The U.S. and China are competing in several arenas on the world stage, from sensitive issues like Taiwan and the South China Sea to intelligence like 5G. The U.S. has labeled China as its biggest national security threat. Whether it would at this length to falsely level an accusation of this magnitude remains to be seen.
The Light.
A herd of wild Asian elephants in China has turned into international stars after leaving their natural habitat in Yunnan province. The herd of 15 elephants is said to have left home in southwest China 15 months ago, but it was in April when they grabbed officials' attention after they were spotted by locals. The elephants have so far trekked nearly 500 kilometers across the country. They have traveled through villages and towns and even stopped for a rest. Local authorities have welcomed these mammoth travelers with treats of sweet corn and bananas. They are monitoring the elephants' movements with drones while keeping them away from residential areas.
Chinese grandma has given a dazzling display of her masterly kung fu performance at a martial arts competition. The 98-year-old woman and her son took the stage as a curtain raiser to the event. The duo put on a kung fu show before a large crowd of spectators who were impressed by her skillful gestures. She was invited to the competition to act as a judge.
I started practicing martial arts when I was only five. I would box every day, learning movements like chopping, pushing palm, and thrusting palm. Though I am old now, my strength hasn't gone.
Zhang says she has inherited her family's martial arts. She's rumored to have a sense of justice from a very young age and try to help others, which earned her quite a reputation where she lives. Traditional martial arts have been passed down in the Zhongqing village located in Zhejiang province for 500 years. Let's go to Italy, where Mount Etna has put on an eye-catching show with its spectacular eruptions. Red-hot lava fountains and plumes of smoke spewed up into the sky. The main eruption was located at the southeastern crater of the volcano. Mount Etna is Europe's tallest active volcano. It's located above the Sicilian town of Catania. It often erupts but rarely causes damage. However, nearby residents have to deal with ash showers. Geological studies show that Mount Etna has been active for more than 2 million years now. Egypt has opened its first archaeological replica factory in an attempt to promote its culture worldwide. The factory was inaugurated in response to people's demand for having detailed copies of ancient treasures. So far, over 6,400 high-quality replicas of ancient Egyptian artifacts have been produced. More than 150 artists work to make the goods out of stone, wood, and even gold.
The materials with which these are made are high quality. The highest and most elegant materials are being used to make these samples, and the materials are very close to those used to make the original artifacts.
The models have certificates showing that they are identical copies of the original artifacts. Each replica also has a barcode that provides extra information about the item. The factory is located in Kayuba, about 35 kilometers northeast of the capital, Cairo.
Now, a lot of people don't like rats and find them disgusting most of the time. However, the rodents are doing life-saving work in Cambodia. Now, the Southeast Asian nation has deployed a new squad of African giant pouched rats to sniff out old landmines. The new recruits have shown an exceptional ability at their task, with their handlers claiming 100% accuracy. There are now nearly 50 demining rats working in the field in Cambodia. The country started using the animal services in 2016, and they have helped detect and clear hundreds of landmines since. Last year, an especially heroic rat called Magawa attracted global fame after receiving a gold medal for his work. The hero rat, who is now retired, detected over 71 landmines.
A muralist from Greece is blending mythology with graffiti and street art to depict how COVID-19 has impacted lives around the globe. Ficus Antonius has painted the walls of many cities around the globe. He is now in the Cypriot capital, Nicosia, to continue his work. His latest artwork depicts Americus, a Cypriot mythical figure who was punished by the gods and turned into a plant. The Greek artist believes this theme is similar to the situation people around the globe have experienced since the pandemic began. He explains many people have grown roots because they're staying in one place for so long. Two British artists have brought a combination of fun, art, and environmental concerns to the sidelines of the G7 summit. They have created a modern-day version of famous sculpture carved into America's Mount Rushmore. This time, it's called Mount Recyclemore. Joe Rush and Alex Rackage have made a sculpture of G7 leaders with electronic waste. They say their major goal is to raise awareness about the amount of unrecycled tech and gadgets, the damage they cause to the environment, and the ways to combat the issue internationally.
Well, what I'd like them to do, the leaders of the G7 conference, is I'd like them all to talk to each other and work out a plan that isn't just shifting the problem from one country to another, you know, but actually is a plan we all work on together, which is how to deal with this waste and how to stop producing so much waste and how to recycle things. And all these issues have got to be dealt with globally. They can't be dealt with nationally, because that's where the problem is. So we need them all to get together, like we put them together here, and deal with the problem.
The United Nations says 53 million tons of electronic waste are generated annually all over the world. It estimates that the amount of the waste will double in less than 30 years. If that happens, electronic waste would become the fastest growing waste stream in the world. Advanced robots are increasingly helping humans in a variety of innovative ways. Now, they have found a place in the healthcare system and will help nurses and doctors stay safe during the COVID-19 pandemic.
I can do all kinds of things for elderly people. I can visit with people and brighten their day with social stimulation, entertain and help guide exercise, but also can do talk therapy, take bio readings and help healthcare providers assess their health and deliver treatments.
Grace, which is the newest humanoid robot to join the healthcare fleet. This intelligent machine can take temperatures and record other vital signs of patients. It has been designed in a way to also interact with the elderly and those isolated by the pandemic. Grace is a new prototype of celebrity humanoid robot, Sophia, created by a robotic team in Hong Kong.
So we designed Grace to look professional in a healthcare setting. So that would mean so that she would resemble the sort of human-like appearance of healthcare staff. And so then this would facilitate more natural interactions. A human-like appearance facilitates trust and facilitates a natural engagement because we're wired for human face-to-face interactions. That's just the way human beings are.
Hansen, while standing between Sophia and Grace, also said that both robots could speak different languages. He said Grace's creation was aimed at relieving the burden of frontline hospital staff dealing with COVID-19 patients. The company is planning a mass production of Grace and offers them to the market by August. The cost of making this robot is similar to a luxury car, but the cost is likely to decrease once the company begins manufacturing it in thousands.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A tiny worm has wriggled back to life after lying frozen for 24,000 years in the permafrost land of northern Siberia. The organism was recovered from soil samples taken from 3.5 meters below the ground in Russia's Yakutia region. It's a multicellular organism that can withstand extreme cold. This ancient worm has broken the record for the longest living abeloid rotifer worm. Previous research suggests that it could survive for a decade when frozen. Earlier, scientists also discovered 30,000-year-old microscopic worms from northern Siberia. Australian scientists have discovered one of the world's largest ever dinosaur species in the Eromanga area in outback Queensland. Research shows the plant-eating sauropod lived between 92 million and 96 million years ago when Australia was attached to Antarctica. Paleontologists estimated the dinosaur was as long as a basketball court and as tall as a two-story building. That makes it the largest dinosaur ever found in Australia and one of the top five largest ones in the world. Bones of the dinosaur were first uncovered more than a decade ago by cattle farmers. Iranian capital Tehran has hosted a festival of cake sculptors. The event showcases delicious sweets that are carved into eye-catching sculptures. Yusuf Jalali has more.
It's not a piece of cake to bake a sculpture, but pastry chefs here have made it. In the fourth festival of cake sculptures in Iran, sugarcraft artists from across the country have come under one roof in Tehran to cast their spell on these sweets and carve a wide range of fascinating 3D figures out of them. From this tasty coronavirus to this beautiful angel that is picking up the only eatable trash in the world.
Here you can see this angel, which represents the innocent heart of labor children, collecting pieces of trash that contain some of the simplest dreams of a labor child, such as quality food, books, and toys.
My cake is made based on what we call installation art. I have put together iconic structures and monuments of Iran, but when you take a look at them from a special angle, you can see Iran's map.
Some of the cake sculptures here have really pushed the envelope of the art of sculpting, like this bust that shows the 13th century Persian poet Rumi
surrounded with a heavenly garden that's decorated with intricate and mind-boggling details. It took its creator almost a month to finish it.
In the middle, I have put the bust of Rumi, who we refer to as Molana in Iran. He's holding his most significant verse work, Masnavi Manavi. The garden I created around him and the birds here all are inspired by his poems.
Organizers say they hold the festival every year to modernize the confectionery industry and combine it with fine arts to make it more appealing to the public.
500 works are showcased here in four sections. Bust cakes, wedding cakes, cookie cakes, which are made using royal icing, and the fourth section is cream cakes. The major goal is to scout for talents who can revolutionize the confectionery industry.
Some of the participants in the festival are pastry chefs who try to make their cakes look better, and others are actually pro sculptors who want to bake a figure instead of carving it. Perhaps it's easy to tell who is who by taking a glimpse at their cakes. But sweets will win the competition. They're both delicious and delicate.
It takes ultimate care and a knack for both bakery and artistry to be able to transform sweets into statues. In fact, they're both so spectacular and yummy that make you want to have the cake and eat it too. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Nowadays, phone addiction is causing an increasing number of accidents worldwide. A Korean engineer has come up with a creative, although satirical, way to tackle that issue. Pang Min-wook is a 28-year-old industrial engineer or designer. He has invented a robotic eyeball people can wear to avoid accidents when using their phones while walking. The device is strapped to the forehead and opens its eyelids when the users lower their heads. The third eye then beeps in warning when the user comes within 1 or 2 meters of an obstacle. Pang says his device is not a solution to the issue and hopes that people will understand the severity of their reliance on gadgets when they see the third eye.
A science professor has released spectacular drone footage of lava streaming from an Icelandic volcano. Sørensen Johnson flew a drone over the volcano 2 months after it started erupting. He captured close-up shots of lava bubbling in its crater in the southwest of Iceland's capital. The volcanologists say that they have no idea how long this eruption will continue, adding that magma could flow for years. Iceland is home to dozens of active volcanoes. Volcanic landscapes have turned into a tourist attraction in the Scandinavian country.
After a year-long delay due to the pandemic, Euro 2020 finally kicks off in Rome, and football lovers all over the world are in a fever. Now, a French baker living in Germany has also seized the moment to create special pastries for the championships. Ludovic Gerboin is a huge football fan. He has made sweets for all the teams present in this year's Euros, but most of his cakes are inspired by the French and German flags. He has mixed bakery traditions from different countries to capture the multinational spirit of the tournament. Ludovic hopes his country of origin, France, will lift the much coveted cup, but he is also favoring Germany.
IRIB English Radio.